do. I'm here to separate the men from the boys. Watch out, men. Here comes the colonel.
Who is she? Wow, it's getting hot in here. Yes. All right, welcome back. The second half hour of The Promise of Tomorrow. Here on the Science News Radio Network, exploring the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. We're going to get right back in a minute, just a minute here. I can't catch my breath. Right back just a minute here with Jack Bishop and today's exciting guest. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments are the voice of reason. Right now, let's step over to our fountain of useless information we keep here on the set to answer today's query.
To the fountain of useless information. How can I help?
Yes, yes, it has been. We've awakened the spirit of the fountain, who knows all, hears all, sees all, and tells all for a price. Well, all we have to do is throw in the coins. Yes, of course. All right. Oh, spirit of the fountain, here's a geographical question for you. A little geology here, and probably a really easy one. There's a small country located between Switzerland and Austria. What is its name? Yes, what small country is located between Switzerland and Austria?
I have given you my answer. And now you may go.
Ah, yes, of course. The fountain knows all, hears all, sees all, and does tell all. The small country located between Switzerland and Austria. You knew this all the time, didn't you? It's Liechtenstein. Yes, we even sent an ambassador to Liechtenstein. Not sure how large it is, but it's pretty darn small. All right, back to Jack Bishop and this segment's exciting guest.
One of the things that we were promised when I was a kid was flying cars and the ability to be invisible. Well, no flying cars yet, at least not that I know of. But Dr. Debash Chandra, who is a scientist and who's with the Nanoscience Technology Center and the College of Optical Photonics at the University of Central Florida, they're working on that. Is that right, Doctor?
Yes, we are actually working on some artificial nanostructure where you can actually bend light in a very different way.
Now, when you say bend light, that sounds awfully science fiction-y to me. Explain that to me, if you would.
The point here is that if you really want to bend a light across an object, and in that way, you need to actually bend in such a way that no light can reflect back, and every light coming towards an object, it just smoothly bends across and goes forward so that you don't actually see that object. To accomplish that, what we have to do really engineer some optical property which allows us to bend the light in a left direction and also right direction, so that when light is coming to that object, it actually bends smoothly in the left and right both ways and just propagates without being reflected.
Now, that sounds pretty simple the way you explain it, but, you know, what kind of mechanism do you use to make that happen?
So what we are doing is we are creating some kind of nanostructure which are composed of metal dielectric patterns, and they have some design resonances, means when light with that wavelength falls onto that nanostructure pattern, they create those resonances, and that resonances make the light to bend or diffract in a very different angle. Means we just the example of the object, that we could actually bend the light to the left and right direction, say for example. So that particular resonance takes the incident light and makes it to bend towards away from that object in one direction and towards the object in another direction, so that it smoothly goes across the object.
Sort of canceling out each other, I guess, right?
It's some kind of combined effect. It's not really total cancellation, but this kind of effective effect that where lights actually create some kind of resonance inside the structure, and in effect they actually propagate in a very different direction than they would have propagated if that nanostructure wasn't present.
Doctor, how did all of this come about, and why are we doing it?
The key point here, I think that's an excellent question. And then the fundamental point here is that the mankind always wanted to have a better control over light, because we want to really manage light for our own benefit. Like, we want to make a high efficient solar cell for our energy need. We want to make a sensor where you can actually measure very minute change of biological activity, like something happening in our body, some change in the biological biomarker in the body. We want to see better in our detector or camera. We want to see far away galaxy using light. So light has enormous impact on our well-being and the development of mankind. So all of this started with that basic fundamental need that we want to really control light the way we want to. Means we want to diffract, scatter, bend in a beneficial way. So that's what actually propelled all of this type of development. We call it meta-material, means where you actually create artificial material where you can actually engineer some artificial properties inside so that you can have a better control over light.
Now, a few years ago, in one of the James Bond movies, he drove an invisible Aston Martin. And while that might come in handy for a spy like James Bond, the kind of science that we're talking about is going to have tremendous implications in a number of areas. You mentioned solar. What about medicine? What's the implication there? You mentioned that a little bit.
Right. So we actually working seriously with medical community to develop optical sensor. Means you have a nanostructure pattern, you just drop up your blood sample or urine sample, and you should be just use a light to tell us, is there anything happening? Say you have a brain injury or early stage of cancer, and your body producing some biomarker in a very minute quantity, and you should be able to detect at a very early stage of your change in biology of your body.
So by having this ability, we might get a jump start on procedures to treat people by months, if not years.
Right. So that's the whole point, that you want to screen people and detect people much earlier than what possible previously, and much cheaper way, because even now all the diagnostic technique needs so much of lab work and human interaction, that somebody has to use a microscope to really see in change of in your red blood cell or some biological component. But what we are trying to develop that is not really human dependent that much. I don't have to be subjective just watching and counting how many red blood cells on a given specimen. My surface itself has that capability. It tells us directly that your one biomarker has been detected with that much of quantity. So the key point is that not only we are trying to detect very minute quantity, but also want to create some kind of intelligence to that material, that it gives us directly and telling us that that material, that small biomarker is present in your body. And that doesn't, it's not a subjective, it's not that somebody has to look at it and tell us based on his experience. It's more of a direct way of measuring and telling people that you indeed have a biomarker for, say, breast cancer, say, for instance.
So, but that biomarker actually telling us what's going on and taking out the human component, we should get much more accurate diagnoses, right?
Yes, that's the whole point, that we want to create much more diagnoses at very early stage of that disease.
My goodness, that just blows my mind, considering the family members that I have lost due to various diseases that if caught earlier, they would still be with us. Doctor, how did you get into this area of research?
Actually, always since childhood, I loved light. Like, light is always a fascinating thing. And then in my high school to graduate level, to PhD, to postdoctoral level, I always worked on light on various aspects. And then over the last decade or so, when I was doing my PhD, this field of artificial nanostructure, metamaterial was evolving. And it caught attention, and we started realizing that this field has way much potential to really create a optical property in inside, which is not present in any other natural God-given material. So that is a big challenge for the whole community to really design this kind of nanostructure material where you can actually create a make light to propagate slow, make light to bend an arbitrarily bigger angle. You can make the structure very sensitive to change to the environment. So you could engineer a lot of those kind of properties in those type of artificial material, which otherwise almost impossible to do in natural medium.
Now, until hearing about you and the work that you're doing, I had not heard anything about anyone working in this area. Are we not hearing about it because it just doesn't rise to the attention of the public, or are we not hearing about it because there are not a lot of people working in the field?
This is kind of a quite relatively new field over the last decade or so. There are quite a few group, is not us, but there are a lot of people across the United States and across the world working. And the key point people face to make those nanostructure, that we don't have a lot of tool available to make them into the nano scale, means the nanometer scale. What we contributed, that we showed that we can actually make those kind of nanostructure very simple, easy, cheap way over a large area. So that was one of our contribution that we came out with. Quite a few fabrication techniques like nano transfer printing technique, nano imprinting technique, where we showed that you can make those nanostructure in a cheap, simple, high throughput manner, so that you can actually now can think about to make the actual device. Previously, it was more of a laboratory development and demonstrations. Nothing really came out for actual application because the process of making them are so expensive and they are so tiny and in quantity that is not really useful for making actual device for real life. But with our work, we hope that we come across that barrier and start making things for real users.
Now, I always like to ask scientists like yourself to speculate on the future. Where do you see it going? Where do you see this research going?
I think this all of this nano-optics and nano-photonic research over the last decade, it actually came up to a level, just an example, that now we are actually making solar cells, which are quite high efficient. So now what the number we're talking about, increase of efficiency almost a double, and we could reduce the thickness of the solar cell by about 10 times. So we could keep the efficiency go high, but using very small amount of material. So that is always important, that we want to use less material and we want to have more efficiency. So that's few things actually coming up, and we are seeing more and more this kind of nanotechnology related material is coming to the market and useful for the mankind in general. So we are optimistic as a community that over time we will start seeing more this kind of the use of nanotechnology into the mankind, from biology to energy harvesting to a lot of defense applications.
And it's all very green, is it not?
Right, yeah, absolutely.
Doctor, I want to thank you for spending this time with us. Dr. Debash Chandra at the University of Central Florida, talking about bending light. Maybe one day for Halloween, my grandkids will go as nothing. Doctor, thank you for being with us, okay?
Thank you for the invitation. I think I love to talk to that, and looking forward to talk to you again.
Time to turn our attentions once again on the Science News Network and the promise of tomorrow towards our correspondent, Desiree Mattel Anderson. Desiree, how are you?
I'm wonderful, Jack. Thanks for having me.
No, thank you for being a part of this. You spent part of the spring out in Washington when those mudslides happened. You were out there assessing the damage and things like that, and you mentioned to me in a conversation that you had seen an awful lot of what we might call new technology being used in correcting things out there. Tell us what you saw.
Absolutely, Jack. In fact, we had a team out there of roboticists, our field innovation team members, and a lot of software engineers assisting the incident command in the Washington mudslides this past spring. For the audience, if you don't know, they had a large mudslide during the spring, and we were able to take out a bunch of team members from the field innovation team, from roboticists to software engineers to a couple of other individuals to assist the incident command in recovery efforts.
Now, you were doing that as part of your other job, but when you talked to me, I was really bowled over by the idea of people in the robotics field being out there. Now, were the robots recovering things and doing reconstruction and search and rescue? What was happening with that?
Well, let's rewind a little bit to find out what exactly was needed.
Okay.
By the incident command, yes, and how we came to the conclusion of what we ended up using at the end of that. The incident command, along with the field innovation team and a group called Precision Hawk and Roboticists Without Borders, got together to look at creating an interactive 3D model, high resolution, 5 centimeter per pixel imagery of the mudslide topography. And the reason we did this, Jack, and again, as a Science News Radio correspondent, really neat to be on the ground seeing this being built from the ground up, it gave the engineers a comprehensive view of the mudslide and the river flooding. They couldn't have gotten that without looking at getting some aerial flight. So with that, to answer your question about getting robotics involved in disaster response, we worked with the Federal Aviation Administration to get an emergency COA approved, and the incident command management, we were able to get flight patterns approved and allow for an unmanned aerial system to fly over a part of the mudslide called the Mooncape to get the imagery we needed in order to build out this model. It's really, really exciting, Jack.
Now, this is a new cutting-edge kind of situation and a new cutting-edge kind of way of handling this problem. I think it's safe to say that this mudslide out on the western part of the country was one of the most devastating mudslides we've ever experienced in this country, correct?
That is correct. It did a lot of damage to property, and unfortunately, there were a lot of lives that were lost.
So what we saw you doing and what you learned is going to be essential, I would say, probably in the event of more mudslides of comparable nature, which we're probably going to have because, you know, these mudslides have a direct correlation to global weather change, does it not?
I can't answer the global climate change question because I'm not an expert in that field, but what I can tell you is that by using progressive technology, such as what we did in the Washington mudslide, we're able to look at providing protection to responders from incipient mudslides. In fact, Norman, who is a disaster specialist and engineer with the incident command, is quoted as saying, "It protects first responders because we don't have to go into dangerous spots just to find out what's there." So this is a really neat way to give people situational awareness of the area around them in a massive mudslide. It could be an earthquake. It could be another disaster.
Mm-hmm.
So that before they go in, they have a virtual tool to assist with deciding how they want to canvas the area.
Now, what kind of mechanics, and by that I mean, what did you actually use to get this insight? I know they did flyovers, but were they mancraft? Were they drones? What were we dealing with there?
They're called, they have lots of different names, but what we used is called an unmanned aerial system, and some people do refer to them as drones, but basically these are aircraft. We used a quad rotor.
Mm-hmm.
We did not use a fixed wing. To go over and fly over the site to get imagery that we then uploaded into software.
And with that upload into software, you could actually assess what was going on, and first responders would have a better chance of not only working the site, but working the site more safely.
Exactly. That's exactly correct. And what we did then was with some software engineers from a couple of different groups, there was PrecisionHawk as well as Autodesk, we got all together to create a 3D model that individuals in the Emergency Operations Center could take a look at. Those models also included LIDAR data from the state of Washington.
So a real coming together of people from different organizations, different fields, and various technologies to get through this incident. Let me ask you this. Did it speed up the process any as far as getting the job done?
In getting the job done, it could expedite things very quickly and potentially be used for life-saving mechanisms. In this mission, we used it in recovery. So it was in a situation where there was no longer life at stake, but we were really excited at the fact that we were able to bring this out for probably one of the very few times in the humanitarian space in the U.S. to get this out. So we're incredibly excited about what the future holds with bringing these progressive technologies with our field innovation team into the next disaster.
I can just imagine what a difference this might have made during the hurricanes, both recently and Katrina a few years ago. Now, I want to shift directions. You and I chatted a little bit about something that you saw in, was it in Florida that you saw?
It was in the Keys.
Oh,
it
in the
was
Florida
in the Keys. Yes.
Oh, hey, I love the Florida Keys. Send me to Key West anytime you can. Now, you were down there because you kind of live not too very far from the Keys, right?
You know, Jack, I live everywhere. I live wherever a disaster or preparedness for disaster is going on.
Well, tell me what you saw in the Florida Keys that you were so excited about when we were talking earlier.
Well, what was really neat is we got invited down. The field innovation team got invited to join the Aquanauts.
The Aquanauts?
Yes, the Aquanauts. They are astronauts under the sea.
Oh, wow.
Yes, very, very exciting. We tested some technology in an underwater facility, one of two in the world, as well as worked with the Aquanaut on hurricane preparedness.
And tell me what you saw there. What kind of technologies were we seeing being used in that situation?
Well, some of the technologies are a bit top secret, but what I can tell you...
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, but what we can tell viewers is we were working on some incredible infrastructure and backbone pieces to allow for disaster response after and prior to setting some things up that will allow people to be able to respond quickly in those disasters. We're quite successful on that mission, but the other very exciting piece of what we were doing was this hurricane preparedness with the Aquanaut and how they were getting revved up in Key Largo to assist their communities as well as the nation with potential disasters in the future. And that was a really exciting story.
Well, that's a story we want you to keep a close eye on, you know, because this is all new stuff in a real world kind of environment, and you're bringing us the updates almost as quickly as they happen. Desiree, I want to thank you once again for being there on the spot for us. She's our girl on the road, Desiree Mattel Anderson.
Thank you, Jack, and I look forward to bringing you more updates on our next disaster series.
And at this time, I want to thank you very much for those of you who have contributed to this program. We depend on contributions from listeners like you for the existence of this show. We're totally science community supported. So those of you who have contributed, thank you very much. Those of you who wish to can do so at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a little tab there for donations. Just click the donations, and we appreciate all your help.
And now, we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
I've been in this business quite some time now, and I continue to be surprised on a daily basis how much there is to learn. And so I think the thing that I pass on is that it's really about lifelong learning and never becoming complacent. There's always something else to understand and to gain insight into, and so I try to go through the day learning as much as I can, and that helps both in this job, but you know, also for other areas of effort that I'm involved in. Dr. Daniel Gerstein, Deputy Undersecretary for Science and Technology at the Department of Homeland Security.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
You live tomorrow, 'cause you know it will be there. I am waiting for you. I am I am free.